give Jim Turner from Athens, Georgia, a big warm welcome.
My name is Jim Turner, and I'm an alcoholic.
Amen.
Robert, thank you very much for asking me to come and speak at the Atlanta Roundup. This is not something I ever considered would be on my radar. So thank you very much. It's quite a privilege to be here. First things first, my sobriety date is August 1st, 2007. So I picked up a blue chip at my home group yesterday, and I was trying to figure out the significance of 11 years, and it hit me. This means I get to stand up for a second and a half longer during sobriety countdowns. My home group is the Lumpkin Street Noontimers group of Alcoholics Anonymous. It meets right across Lumpkin Street from the UGA track. It's right near campus. And it's a wonderful home group. It's the only home group I've ever had. At any given time, there's 200 to 300 years of sobriety sitting in the room. And I figured they could maybe help me. And apparently they have. So if you're ever in Athens around the lunch hour on Mondays, Wednesdays, and Fridays, please come and visit us. It's a wonderful solution-based, step-based, tradition-based group. I have a great sponsor. There's a guy named David Kidd. Many of y'all know him. The reason I picked David as my sponsor, if you look at the pamphlet, Questions and Answers on Sponsorship, and I think it's the second page, but anyway, it's in the section about how to choose a sponsor. And it says something to the effect, try to select someone who's at least a year away from their last drink and seems to be really enjoying their sobriety. And I picked David because of all the people in Athens I knew at the time, he seemed to be enjoying his sobriety more than anyone that I could tell. And David is an interesting guy. He's always laughing. He's one of the funniest people I've ever met. And he's always this far from being in trouble. But he never gets there, you know. And I thought, maybe he can teach me how to pull back on the reins a little bit and not cross that line of getting into trouble. So I think it was about 5 or 6 years ago, I was up at Lake Lanier Islands at Woodstock of the South, and we were listening to Polly Pistol speak. And Polly said something that kind of summed up my alcoholism perfectly. And what she said was, the chains of alcoholism were too soft to be felt before they became too strong to be broken. And that really struck a chord with me. Because I drank for 31 years. And the first 25 of them weren't that bad. They were actually kind of nice. There were minimal consequences. I hear somebody in an AA meeting every now and then will say something like, you know, my worst day sober was better than my best day drunk. That is simply not true for me. If that's the case, you should have been with me in 1978. You wouldn't be saying that now. But what happened was, somewhere around year 24, 25, something changed. There were indications, however, along the way that alcohol might prove to be a problem in the future. And I'll give you a good example of that. I met my wife up in the Raleigh area, and we were both working for the same international chemical company, and we kind of had a little professional mutual admiration society thing going on. And so we started dating, and she moved in with me. And if that offends anyone, I'm really sorry. And so we were really hard workers. Before I became an alcoholic, I was a workaholic. And so we would take 1 week's vacation every year. So we would always go to the Outer Banks and rent a house right on the beach. And so we did that. I think this was in 1992. And we got there, and we got up the first morning, It was a Monday morning. And I said, you know what, I think I'll make us a pitcher of Bloody Marys, and let's just sit out on the deck and watch the waves roll in. And my wife said, that sounds great, honey. So I made us a pitcher of Bloody Marys, and we sat out there and talked, and it was the perfect day. There was not a cloud in the sky. The air was warm. You could smell the salt air coming off the water. It was just perfect. In a little while, she finished her drink, and she said, I think I'm going to go in and make breakfast. Would you like me to fix you some? And I said, no, that's okay. I said, we've got the rest of this pitcher to finish. I'll just stay out here and enjoy myself. And she said, okay. And so she went inside, and I continued to finish the pitcher of Bloody Marys. And then I went and made another one. And I came back out, and so she comes out about, I don't know, noon, 12:30, something like that. And she goes, honey, she goes, I'm going to make some sandwiches for lunch. You want me to fix you a couple of sandwiches? And I look at her, and I go, no, man, I'm good. I'm really good. I'm enjoying the weather, and it's really nice. And, you know, see, I'd run out of tomato juice like 2 hours ago. But I didn't let that stop me. So about 3:30, she comes out, and she says, honey, she goes, you're getting a lot of sun. I'm really concerned that, and I think maybe you should put on some sunscreen. And I looked at her and I said, real men don't wear sunscreen. And she said, okay. About 5:30, I woke up, came to. And I realized I'd promised to take her out to supper to her favorite seafood restaurant that night. And so I hobbled into the bathroom, and I looked like a lobster. I mean, it was bad. I was beet red. And I remember turning on the shower, and it felt like hot needles hitting my skin. So I got dried off, and I got dressed very gingerly, and I walked back into the den like this, you know, trying to move as little as humanly possible. And she's standing there with her arms crossed. And she looks at me and she says, it's a good thing you're a real man, or I bet that hurt like hell. Timothy McVeigh blew up the federal building in Oklahoma City the next morning, and I had sun poisoning. And I had to stay inside the rest of the week and watch that on TV. So that was my reward for the Bloody Mary episode. So Barbara and I were working up in North Carolina, and when we got married, we desperately wanted to have kids. We really, really wanted to have kids. And so we started trying, which, as you are well aware, is great fun. But it just didn't work out. And so we started to get a little desperate, and we went to this place called the North Carolina Center for Reproductive Medicine, and we started trying these other things. We tried fertility drugs, we tried in vitro fertilization, and then we tried a donor egg. And nothing would work. Nothing would work. And we were getting frustrated, and she finally, we did a second donor egg, and she finally got pregnant and miscarried at 12 weeks. And it was devastating. And so my dad had told me growing up, he said, you know, I'm an only child. And he said, if you don't have a son, the Turner name dies with you. And I look back on that now and I go, what, that's some sort of catastrophe? But at the time, it really meant a lot to me. I thought, okay, I've got this pressure on me. I have to produce. And so we ended up moving to Athens. We both quit our jobs and moved to Athens and opened our own company. And my wife was actually my quality assurance officer, and she used to audit me. And if you've ever had never had your spouse audit you, it's great fun. But anyway, we started trying to adopt. And we end up finally adopting a little girl. And the next day, the birth mother took her back. And it was the hardest thing that we've ever gone through. And I called our lawyer and I said, I can't take this. This is an emotional roller coaster. This has been going on for 5 years. I can't take this anymore. Cease and desist. And I started to drink. I would say that life became disenchanting for me, but that's not strong enough. I got filled with self-pity and anger, and I started to drink. And I drank, and I drank, and I drank. Barbara and I would have cocktails at night, just like any normal couple would. And one day she said, "You seem to be drinking a little bit more at night than you used to." And I said, "Yeah." I said, "I'll cut back. I'm just going to limit myself to two a night." And what I did was I switched from a rocks glass to a Collins glass to an iced tea glass. But by God, I still only had two. And as I drank more and more at night, I started to be more and more hungover. And we had our own company, and so our office was downstairs. When I got to put on a coat and tie and go to see a boss every morning, I can kind of maintain. But when I'm the boss and the office is downstairs, it ain't going to happen. And I was just miserable. I felt like a complete failure in life. I had buddies that all they did was look at their wives and they got pregnant. You know, it seemed that way. And so I just started to drink more and more. And what happened was I would be more hungover in the morning. And I remembered Bloody Marys. And so I would get up extra early in the morning. And I would go into the kitchen and I would drink a Bloody Mary. And that would do wonders for the hangover. The only problem is about 11:30, I'd have to do it again. And then about 3:30, I'd have to do it again. And so I somehow worked myself into this hangover deferment program. And over the course of a year, I was drinking around the clock. And something happened because I kind of moved away from personal hygiene. I quit bathing. I quit brushing my teeth. I quit brushing my hair. I quit shaving. I just got nasty. And apparently I would snore really bad at night. And Barbara took exception to that. And so one day she says, "I think it'd be a good idea if you moved upstairs into the guest bedroom." And I thought, cool. Because at that point, I'm physically addicted to the alcohol. And I've got a vodka bottle underneath the bed. And when I wake up at 2 or 3 in the morning and she's sleeping beside me, I've got to get that bottle out and get 3 or 4 shots down. And the trick was keeping them down. Because I'm sweating and I'm shaking. And it's just going to get worse unless I can get some liquor in me. And so I realized if I get to go upstairs, I can keep a handle of vodka under the bed. This will be great. So I moved upstairs. We had a dog. His name was Mosby. He was about 95 pounds. He was a combination black lab chow. And Mosby moved upstairs with me. And Mosby thought it was awesome because he got to sleep on the bed and he was not the worst smelling thing in the room. On June 29th, 2007. So I got to tell you something, a little bit about Barbara. I love my wife dearly, but at the time she was the most severe untreated Al-Anon I've ever seen in my life. She would get I'm a page 22 guy. Okay. I've got bottles stashed all around the house. You know, you read 21 and 22 and I hit for the cycle. Okay. So she finds, and this is a Friday morning, she finds a major stash of vodka and dumps it out. Okay? And sometimes she would dump it out and leave about this much in the bottom of the bottle. Other times, she would dump it out and fill it back up with water because she thought I wouldn't notice. She dumped out a bunch of vodka, and I looked at it, and I said, there is no way I can possibly make it through the end of the day with what I have left, much less the weekend, so I got to go to the liquor store. So I jumped in my car like I did and drove to the liquor store, bought a couple of handles of vodka, started driving back home, got in my subdivision, and managed to get a DUI. And the officer, I remember Athens Clark County police officer, he was such a nice guy. He says, Mr. Turner, he said, I'm going to need to get you to take a breathalyzer. Would you be willing to do that for me? And he said, and I said, absolutely, officer, I would love to do that for you. And so I start blowing in the little thing, right? And what I didn't know was he turned it off at 0.3. This was 2 o'clock in the afternoon. It's a good thing he didn't catch me at 5. Then he says, I'm going to need to get you to do a field sobriety test. And I told him, I said, officer, I've fallen down in front of you 3 times already that I can remember. I'm thinking you should just take me to jail. So I put my hands behind my back and, you know, he cuffed me and took me to jail. They did another breathalyzer at the Clark County Jail when I arrived, and it was a .38. And I figure if you're going to get a DUI, you may as well be 4 times the legal limit, right? So anyway, my wife came and bailed me out. And I got home, and the first thing I did was, guess what? Turned up a bottle of vodka. With such a high blood alcohol content, I hired a lawyer, and he goes, this is bad. This is really bad. He goes, it's your first offense, but this is really bad. He said, they're going to have a field day with you, man. He said, I need you to go ahead. First of all, I need you to stop drinking. And I said, okay. And he said, I want you to go ahead and sign up for DUI school because I need you to go get that certificate and we'll take it into court with us. Well, you know, that'll show the judge you're being proactive with, you know, your drinking. And I said, okay, great. And so what's important to understand is about 6 months prior to this incident, I thought very wittily convinced my doctor that I was suffering from a severe benzodiazepine deficiency. and he prescribed Ativans. And so I would take 2 Ativans and drink a quart of vodka, and I wouldn't remember anything. For example, I have 0 recall of the entire month of April 2007. I have no idea what happened. None. So what I did was I stopped drinking, but I continued to take the Ativans. And that's a good thing because, well, I don't know about that. You'd have a different speaker here tonight, I feel certain, because benzos are wonderful detox meds. They're great anticonvulsants because I can't imagine I wouldn't have died with a seizure. So I quit drinking. I didn't drink for 10 days. I got my little DUI certificate. And you know, I'm one of these people where I don't really have to know very much about something to be an expert on it. You may know people like that. And so I didn't know really anything about alcoholism. And I thought, you know, I don't really know what an alcoholic is. I mean, my wife had been screaming at me for a couple of years now that you're an alcoholic. But I didn't know what that was. But I was very certain that they could not go 10 days without drinking. And so I rationalized that I can't possibly be an alcoholic. I'm going to have a cocktail with my wife tonight. However, I made myself the solemn oath. Here it comes. I will never, ever, 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 ever get behind the wheel of a car again today after I've been drinking because I have a DUI and it's still pending. So I had the drink with my wife. It worked pretty well. The only downside to that was 4 days later, I'm back to a quart of vodka again and I'm driving blind. I'm driving drunk. And if that's not powerlessness, I do not know what is. So on July 31st, 2007, and I know this is true because I have the police report to prove it. My dad called me up and he said, I need you to go over to my house and do some work for me. And I said, okay. And he was out of town. And so I drove over to his house. And I didn't really want to do the work that he wanted me to do. I wanted to just work over his liquor cabinet. So that's what I did. And I remember getting in the truck at his house. And I don't remember anything about driving home except when I got home and got out of the truck, I looked at the truck and there was a big dent there that was not there when I left. And I thought, wonder what I hit. And I got to thinking about it and I said, you know, God, I hope I didn't hit a dog. It would be awful. And then I said, God, what if I hit a human? And then it hit me that what if I hit a child? And I came out of a blackout into a moment of clarity. Because that scared me so bad. It was the first time ever that I had considered that my drinking could be harmful to someone other than me. Because when I'm drinking, I am selfish and self-centered and I don't think about anybody else. And it dawned on me right then and there, you were not put on this earth to hurt people. That's not why you're here. This has got to stop. This has got to change. And so the only place that I ever been able to stay sober was in the Clark County Jail, and I'm not like a real super huge fan of that place. And so I put myself in treatment. I just went and surrendered to treatment center. And so I remember the first day we were in treatment, we were eating lunch, you know, and I vaguely remember this. And they said, okay, everybody, let's go get in the car. And I said, why? And they said, because we're going to AA. And I said, oh, no, we're not. And they said, yeah, we're going to AA. Come on, Jim, get in the car. And I was like, I'm paying you people a lot of money. You're supposed to fix me. I remember most of that assessment, and no one mentioned AA, you know. And they said, look, this is a treatment center. We can detox you. We can stabilize you. We can educate you. But if you want any hope at long-term sobriety, you have got to go to Alcoholics Anonymous. Get in the car. I didn't have the gift of desperation. I had the gift of exhaustion. And at that point, I just said, okay, I'll do whatever. I don't care. And so they started taking me to AA every day, every day. And it was interesting because in about 10 days to 2 weeks, I was an alcoholic. I started listening to what y'all were saying in the meetings. And I started identifying with what you were saying in the meeting. See, people would ask me, we don't understand why you just don't quit drinking. Why don't you just quit drinking? Look at all this trouble it's causing in your life. Why don't you just quit? And I would go, I don't know. I don't know, which was true. And I would say, you just don't understand. That was my final line of defense, and it worked every time, right up to the point I got into AA. Because you guys are the only ones on the planet that do understand. That was no longer a valid excuse. So at this treatment center, they have a deal where you got to get a sponsor, you got to get a home group, and you got to start working steps or you do not leave that place. And, you know, my normal day there, my case manager, a guy named Joe, and I love Joe today. I did not like Joe at the time. I'd be like, you know, this is what he sounded like to me. And I'd be like, Jesus, Joe, I can go home and get yelled at. But why do we have to do this here, you know? Anyway, after I became an alcoholic, I remember I was sitting in the, we used to have a big clubhouse in Athens called the Cobb House. It was an old antebellum mansion, and thousands of AAs got sober there. Maybe tens of thousands, I don't know. And I remember sitting in the Cobb House, and I was reading the steps on the wall. And I remember reading step two, came to believe that a power greater than ourselves could restore us to sanity. And I thought, you know what, I know where this is going. They're not fooling me. And I cheated, and I went ahead to step three, and there it is. There's that God word. I knew it was coming. And so I went back to the treatment center, and my counselor, Joe, said, "What is wrong with you, man? You seem very upset." And I said, "Well," I said, "I just don't think I can do this, Joe." And he said, "Why not?" And I said, "Because when I was a little boy, I got molested by a priest." And this was in the early 1960s, and it was not cool to say anything back then. And I came home and I told my parents what had happened. And they were doing the best they could. I don't fault them for this, but they said, "You know, this will bring shame onto our family. If word ever gets out, you can never tell anyone this as long as you live." And I didn't understand that. I was just a little boy. I was like, but it was wrong. And so I stuffed that very deeply inside me. I filed it away. And what I got was, see, now I know it's called a resentment. I didn't know what it was before. I didn't get a resentment towards the sick old man. I got a resentment towards the entirety of organized religion, because that's the way my alcoholic brain thinks. And so for the next 45 years, I had no God, nothing in my life. And I was perfectly happy with that. Now, it didn't work out too well, obviously, because I'm in a treatment center. And he said, "Jim," he said, "you're mistaken." He said, "You seem to think AA is a religious program, and it's not. It's a spiritual program." And I said, "What's the difference?" And he said, "Come with me." He took me in his office, and he printed this thing out off the Internet. And because it came from the Internet, I knew it had to be true. But it was a quote by the Dalai Lama. And I can't quote it to you, but it said something like this. It said, "Religion I take to be associated with one faith tradition or another, usually involving the acceptance of some form of metaphysical or supernatural being, including dogma, ritual, prayer. Spirituality, on the other hand, I take to be associated with those qualities of the human spirit, like love and compassion and forgiveness and patience and courage and tolerance, a sense of harmony, a sense of responsibility that brings happiness to both self and others." And he said, "I sometimes believe that religion is something we could perhaps do without. But what we cannot do without are these basic human qualities of the spirit." And when I read that, it opened the door for me that far. That far. And that's all I needed. And I said, "You know what? That's cool. I can do this. I can do this." So I had a sponsor, and I remember I did my fourth step. And I learned some very valuable information about myself. I've been going to therapists for 20 years at $150 an hour. And I didn't learn really very much about myself. I learned some big words and how to write checks, but that was about it. But I learned some really great information about myself. Like, apparently I have a rather high opinion of myself, artificially so. And I think I'm smarter than everybody else. I think I'm better than everybody else. And when I was younger, I thought I was better looking than everybody else. And that's not true. I was shocked. I was stunned. My sponsor used the seven deadly sins with me. And so every time we'd go through a resentment, he would match it up with one of the seven deadly sins. And by the time we got through with my fifth step, I was thrilled that there was only seven of them. You know, we did step six and seven sitting in the cab of my pickup truck outside his home group one night. It took about 10 minutes. And I started making my eight-step amends list. And I remember I had, by the time we sat down and whittled it down, I had 36 people on that amends list. And so I started making my amends. And my sponsor instructed me very specifically. He said, "Under no circumstances will you use the words, 'I'm sorry.' If I hear you use the words, 'I'm sorry,' you've had it." And I said, "Okay, well, what am I supposed to tell you? You tell them you were wrong. You tell them you are wrong. And so I made amends to my dad and my wife because those were the two closest people to me. My mom was no longer around. She died in 2001. And I started going through this list making my amends, and I was telling everybody I was wrong and what can I do to make it up. And y'all know how it goes. And I got down to 9 people, and I could not find the last 9 people. Now, by this time, Barbara had invited me to move back downstairs, and I was sleeping in the big bed again. I was bathing. You know, I've got I think I was 4 days shy of a yellow chip, which in Athens is 6 months. So we were in the bed, and the phone rang. It was like a Thursday night, Friday morning, middle of the night type thing. And the phone rang, and I opened one eye and looked at it, and I was reading the caller ID, and it said Athens Regional Medical Center. And I remember distinctly thinking, this can't possibly be good news. And I answered the phone, and it was the emergency room, and they said, your father has had a massive brain hemorrhage. You need to get here as soon as possible. And I said, okay. And I hung up the phone. Barbara said, who's that? And I told her. And see, I don't have a driver's license at this point because I'm in trouble with the law still. And bless her heart, she got up and we got dressed and we went tearing down to the hospital. And he had had a brain hemorrhage right in the center of his brain. It was 7 centimeters in size. And they couldn't operate because they would have destroyed more brain tissue trying to get at it to do something. It just wasn't going to work. And so they got him stabilized, and he slipped into a coma, and they moved him upstairs to the 6th floor to neuro ICU. And I stayed at the hospital all that Friday, and I didn't go to my home group. And about 1:30, my cell phone started ringing. And it was people from my home group saying, where are you, man? You don't ever miss a meeting. What's going on? What's happening? And I said, well, this thing happened with my dad. I don't really know, you know, what's happening. And anyway, so word spread like wildfire through Athens AA. You got to understand, I'm not even 6 months sober yet, so I've known most of these people like 2 or 3 months, right? And my phone rang and rang and rang and rang, and I had to ask my wife if she would go home and get the charger because people were calling me so often that I couldn't keep the battery charged on the thing. And I remember about 10 o'clock that night, I'd been on the phone almost all day long. And about 10 o'clock that night, I was sitting cross-legged on the floor outside of his room in the hallway, and she comes out and she goes, now who are you talking to? And I go, honey, I don't know. It's these damn alcoholics. They just keep calling me. I do not understand what's going on with this, you know. And see, that was the first time I ever really experienced the fellowship, how much we care for each other. And I was very touched by that. He laid in the hospital for 6 days. She took me to an AA meeting every day. And I would go to the meeting, and I was exhausted emotionally. And I would go to a meeting, and you guys would recharge my batteries. And you would say, Jim, you're going to be okay. And you'd hug me and say, you can do this. You can handle this. You can stay sober. You can do this. And I'd go back to the hospital. And he was dating this lady. I had his living will in my pocket. And I'm his legal. I'm it. There's nobody else. And what the living will said, if I ever become incapacitated, remove all the life support. No food, no water, no meds, no oxygen, no nothing. And he was on full life support. And he was dating this lady, and I went to her and I said, I think I might need to do this. And she said, you can't kill him. Please don't kill him. And I thought, oh, man, okay. And so he ended up getting pneumonia. And I thought, maybe he's going to pass. Maybe he's going to pass, and I'm not going to have to do this. But, of course, they shot him full of antibiotics and brought him right back. And on the 6th day, I finally just said, I can't do this anymore. He's laying there. I don't even know if he's – I don't know what's going on. And I just said, I've got to honor what this says. And so I asked the neurosurgeon to do that. And so he came in, and the staff, they removed all the life support. And that afternoon, my sponsor and my wife and myself sat there while the needles clicked down and my dad departed this earth. The reason I share that with you, remember those 9 people that were on my amends list that I couldn't find? Guess what? All 9 of them came to the hospital during those 6 days. And I said, you know, there's an empty waiting room over there. I need about 3 to 5 minutes of your time. Would you please? And they said, certainly. So that Sunday afternoon, as my dad left us, or my amends were done. And I didn't have to lift a finger to do it. Now, I don't know what the odds are of that. But for a guy who's an agnostic with a bad attitude, that's kind of hard to deny. And I'd always wondered if I did the right thing. You know, I questioned myself. I doubted myself. Did you do the right thing? Did you do the right thing? And about a year later, this young lady asked me if I would speak at her first birthday. And this was, so I said, sure, I'll do that. And so I went to the Athens Young People's Group. And I told them what I just told you about my dad. And there was one lady that was there, a young lady that was celebrating 7 years. And so I sat down, and sitting about where Joe is, and on the front row, and her dad goes up to give her this 7-year medallion. And he's standing there, and tears start running down his cheeks. And I'm like, you know, we're going out to supper afterwards. I'm hungry. I'm a year and a half sober. I'm still selfish, okay? So I'm like, come on, dude, give her the medallion. Let's go. Lay the medallion on her. We got sushi to eat. Let's go. And he starts crying. I'm like, it's 7 years. You know? And he looks right at me. And he goes, I don't know if you know this or not. I was one of your dad's doctors. He came to me 2 days before he had that brain hemorrhage, and he commented to me, if something happens to me and I become incapacitated, I hope my son has the courage to pull the plug. Now, I'm crying. Only in Alcoholics Anonymous does this stuff kind of happen. And you know what? It's strangely commonplace that it does. Think about it. Only in AA does this kind of stuff happen. So I want to finish up talking a little bit about service. The 12th step, I love all the steps, don't get me wrong. The 12th step, maybe I'm a little partial to. It's the only step that really makes reference to all three of our legacies. You know, we got the circle and triangle thing, right? Recovery, unity, service. If you think about it, the 12th step says, having had a spiritual awakening is the result of these steps. See, that's recovery. We tried to carry this message to alcoholics. That's service. And practice these principles in all our affairs. That's unity. And so, I'd gone back, I think at about 2 months sober, I'd gotten done with part of the treatment, and I'd gone back into the Clark County Jail to serve out the balance of that DUI sentence. And at the Clark County Jail, at least the old jail anyway, they had a long asphalt ramp that went up to an outer gate. And I remember when they released me, my wife was in the parking lot ready to pick me up, and I remember walking up this ramp going, you know what, the only time she's ever been to jail is to get me. But I'm walking up the ramp, and I said to myself, you know, I've never been to jail when it wasn't because of drinking. And so now that I'm sober, I'm never, ever, 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 ever going to come back into a jail again as long as I live. And apparently my higher power thought that was hilarious. Because a year later, I'm smoking cigarettes outside my sponsor's home group, and back when I smoked, and this guy comes up and he goes, hey man, you want to help us carry meetings into the Clark County Jail? And my brain goes, why the hell would I ever want to do something like that? And out of my mouth comes, okay. That was about as spiritual as I could get in those days. Okay. And so I filled out the paperwork. They turned it in. The jail lost it. I was thrilled with the fact that my Social Security number was floating around the Clark County Jail for a while. Filled it out again, turned it back in, and they approved me. And I started going in and doing jail meetings. And I absolutely fell in love with it. I thought it was just the neatest thing ever. And I became one of these type of people where if you chain me to a desk and it's jail night, guess what? The desk is going in with me. You know, it just became that important, and I just developed a passion for it. And so I was at a district meeting. I was actually serving as alternate GSR for my home group at that point. And I was at a district meeting, and our district corrections rep had gotten elected as alternate DCM. And so it was the end of the meeting. They said, anybody have any AA announcements? And he goes, yeah. He says, I can't be corrections rep anymore for the district, being the alternate DCM, so Jim's going to take over for us. And I thought, okay, whatever. That's actually how I became GSR. The day I picked up my blue chip, my two-year blue chip, not the medallion, the blue one, it goes, anybody got any announcements? And our GSR says, yes, effective immediately. I'm stepping down. Jim's going to take over. And I'm like, okay, so this is how it works in AA, right? Okay? And so I started coming to Macon and attending the corrections meetings and was, you know, the one thing about AA is great. It's like if you've got a question about AA and you're willing to do some reading and some research, you can find the answer to everything. It is amazing how much literature we have on every imaginable subject. And so I read up on the corrections stuff and you know, started going to the corrections meetings in Macon at the assembly. And in 2010, it was the last time we hosted the prepaid in Athens. And so I was the registration chair in 2010. So I had a little table set up down there at assembly. And so I was being a good boy. It was on Saturday morning. And Patty, who was our delegate at the time, had just gotten out of her, this was September assembly, had just gotten out of her meeting with the area chairs and area co-chairs. And she's coming down the hallway, and I'm sitting there, you know, signing people up. And I look, and I go, oh, there's Patty. She's the delegate. I'm not really sure what that means, but she's the delegate. And she stops about 20 feet away and does this, like, come here. And I'm like, oh, no, what did I do? I didn't do anything, you know. So I go up, and I go, yes, ma'am. And she says, I was wondering if you'd consider serving as area co-chair for corrections. And I was like, I said, I don't think I have enough time. And she said, how long have you been sober? And I had a three-year medallion in my pocket. It was still warm. And I said, I've just been sober 3 years. And Patty, if you know Patty, you know she always carries a service manual with her. And she whips it out and she goes, well, I haven't had the service manual right here, Jim. Let's just check and see on that, shall we? And she says, oh, it says right here, 2 to 3 years continuous sobriety in the state of Georgia. Sorry, that won't work. And I said, okay, I'll do it. I had no idea what I was getting myself into. And so for the next 2 years, I got to serve as area co-chair and then 2 years as area chair for corrections for the state of Georgia. And it was, at that time, the neatest experience I'd ever had in my life. I do know this. I got the opportunity to go into more men and women's prisons than I ever felt necessary in those 4 years. But it was really neat. I learned how to use the traditions and to a great extent the concepts. I mean, don't get me wrong. I got a long way to go on that. But it was nice because I had to learn how to solve problems in Alcoholics Anonymous using the traditions and to some extent the concepts. And while I was doing my second year as area chair, there was a lady up at GSO named Eva Sanchez. And Eva was working the corrections desk. And so at the end of that year, I think we were at the DCM planning meeting in Macon, and Patty comes up to me, and she says, are you rotating off at the end of this year? And I said, no, ma'am, I got one more year. And she said, okay, never mind. And I said, you can't do that. You can't come up and ask me a question and go, oh, never mind. I said, what did you want? And she said, well, I'm going to be the chair for the International Convention, and I was wanting to know if you would be one of my co-chairs. And I said, yes. And she said, Jim, you got another year. I said, look, my co-chair needs to learn how to do this. I'm going to start turning stuff over to him anyway. He ain't going to learn any younger. Yes, ma'am, I'd like to. She goes, why don't you think about it for a month? And she called me a month later, and she said, have you thought about it, Jim? I said, yes, ma'am, I have. And she said, you want to do it? And I said, yes, ma'am, I do. And she said, are you sure? And I said, yes, ma'am, I am. I said, Patty, look, this international convention is, it's going to be in my backyard. It's never going to be this close again in my lifetime. And so I'd be an idiot not to accept. And she said, okay. So we started meeting. I think it was the first of the next year. We started meeting, and I look around this room, and there's a bunch of people that were on that committee, and it was just a great experience. So I think it was August of 2014. My phone rings, and I hear this voice on the phone going, hi, Jim, this is Eva Sanchez from GSO. It's funny because that's the only Eva I know on the whole planet. But she always has to say, this is Eva Sanchez from GSO. And I go, hey, Eva, how you doing? You know, because I'd gotten to know her when she was working the corrections desk. And she was now the chair for the International Convention. And she said, I'm doing great. She goes, do you have a few minutes? I go, well, of course I have a few minutes for you. And she says, okay, so I'm going to tell you something, but before I tell you, you have to promise me to never share this with anyone. And I'm thinking, the hell? I said, okay, Eva, what, sure, whatever, you know. And she said, I would like to do something that's never been attempted in the history of Alcoholics Anonymous before. I said, okay, sounds good. She goes, I would like to get an inmate from the Georgia Department of Corrections prison system, released for one day to speak at the International Convention. And I thought, my God, I'm on the phone with a crazy woman. You know? I'm like, what? You know? And I said, Eva, I said, I can't imagine they would do that. But I said, you know what? If you want to try, I'm your boy. And she said, okay, we're going to do this. So we started trying to identify an inmate that might be able to do this. Because she said, you know, do you know an inmate that the AA program has had a really strong impact on? And so we had a few of them around the state. And so we ended up picking a guy who I had met in 2011. And he was, at the time, incarcerated at Jackson County Correctional Institute, which is a county prison that houses state inmates in Jackson County. And I did the meetings in there every Thursday night. And so I found out that he had been transferred up to Walker State Prison, which is just inside Georgia. It's like 15 miles south of Chattanooga. And he was working on the fire team up there. And so we tracked him down and approached him and asked him if he would be willing to do something like this. And he didn't know what he was getting himself into, you know. You know what the International Convention is. And he said, sure, I'd love to do that. He goes, for all AA has done for me, sure, I would love to do that. And I said, okay. And so what would happen would be whenever we'd have supper with the GSO people, the committee would meet with the GSO people once every other month or so, or however often it was. And Eva and I would sneak off around the corner and, like, compare notes. And so my job was, because she asked me, she goes, do you know, at some point she said, do you know if Jason's ever worked the steps? And I said, I don't know. And she goes, Jim, we can't have someone speaking at the International Convention that's never worked the steps. And I'm like, you know, that's a really good point, Eva. So it became her job to get him released for prison for a day, and my job to take him through the steps. I figured I had the easy job, you know. And so on weekends when the host committee wasn't meeting, we met at NAVA every month, and for weekends that the host committee wasn't meeting, I would go up to Walker, and we would sit in the visitation lobby, and we went through the steps together. And we would sit there for 6 hours, and it was grueling, right? And there's 100 people in there, and everybody's talking, and we're trying to do step work. And it was really interesting. So I'd go up, come back, go up, come back, go up, come back. And and I would always wear my Department of Corrections volunteer badge. And so one night, or one morning, we got up there one Saturday morning, and I was standing in the line. There's, you know, all the parents, everybody's a ton, really long lines, And one of the correctional officers goes, sir, you can come to the front of the line. She'd seen my badge. And I was like, okay. And this lady goes, why does he get to go to the front of the line? And the officer goes, because he's a pastor. I have a personal policy never to argue with a correctional officer. So I went to the front of the line. But it was really interesting because I think one of the coolest things we get to do in Alcoholics Anonymous, and you guys know this. You ever been working with somebody and the light is out? There's nothing in their eyes. They're just dead inside. There's just nothing there. And one of the coolest things we get to do, we go through the steps with people, is every now and then you'll start to see a little bit of a flicker. Just a little bit of a dash of light there. And it starts to get stronger and more steady and brighter. And I've never seen that happen as dramatically as it did with Jason. He had been carrying around this guilt. He said in the Georgia Dome that morning, he was in prison for a vehicular homicide. He killed a guy in a blackout. He had no recall of it. Woke up on a gurney in Grady Hospital, handcuffed to the gurney with police officers all around him. He said, what the hell's going on? He didn't know. And I think that perhaps that's maybe the most scary thing that any of us could have ever done. That was always in the back of my mind, which I think is why he was the perfect guy to do that. He carried around a level of guilt and shame like I've never seen before. And when we did his fourth and fifth step and did his eighth and ninth steps and he started to make his amends, I saw that light come on in his eyes. And it changed him at his core. It was the most amazing thing I had seen. So Eva calls me one day and she goes, okay, Jim, what do you think? Is this going to happen or not? Because we don't know. And she goes, I got to print the program today. And I need to know to put Jason's name in there or not. And I go, Eva, I said, I don't know. I said, I have a really good feeling about it. I do know this. If God wants him in that dome, there's nothing you and I can do to screw it up. And if he doesn't, there's nothing you and I can do to make it happen. I said, if I was you, I'd go ahead and print it with it in there. I think we're going to be okay. And she said, okay. And she was so funny. At one point she called me and she said, does Barbara know what you're doing? And I said, no, ma'am. You told me you'd kill me if I told anyone. She says, I think you need to tell Barbara. And I said, well, I really don't have to. I said, she just thinks I'm working with another inmate. It's not that, you know, not that big a deal. And she said, no, tell her. And so I went to my wife and I told her what we were up to. And my wife goes, I just thought you and Eva were crazy. Now I know you are. She goes, it really concerns me that you're hanging out with her, Jim. So anyway, we came down to the convention. And so how many people were in the Georgia Dome that Sunday morning? Wow. A lot. So you know what happened. He stood up there. He stood up there. This was not only the first time he'd ever told his story. It was the first time he'd ever been to an AA meeting outside of a prison. So no pressure. Now, Patty and I, we were supposed to, the arrangements were, he had what they call the CERT squad, which is, CERT is Correctionals Emergency Response Team. There were these two guys that were his escort. They were dressed out in full battle gear. The little guy was 6'7". Everybody on the CERT squad is former Navy SEAL. And they're stationed up at Hayes Prison, which is up in North Georgia, which is about the nastiest prison we've got. The bad actors are there. And that's where these guys live. And so they escorted him down. And the deal was that Eva told me, she goes, you're going to have to keep him calm. And I'm thinking, who the hell's going to keep me calm? You know? And so he had called me every night that week, and he would do his story. We had a setup where he could do 2 15-minute phone calls in a row. And so he would, his talk could only be 20 minutes. So he would do his story, and we would practice during that week. And the last night before he left, 24 hours before they move an inmate, they always put him in the hole. And he told me, he said, I'm not going to be able to call you tomorrow night because I'm going in the hole. And I said, I'm so sorry to hear that, man. And he goes, Jim, I'd stay in the hole for a month for Alcoholics Anonymous. It was not a problem. And so he came out. We met in the green room that morning, and we hugged and we prayed together and we talked and we laughed. And he went out on the stage, and y'all know what happened. There was not a dry eye in the place. And after we got done, at the end of that was the closing meeting. At the end of the meeting, Patty and Tom and I got to go up on the stage, which was a real treat for me. And as we were leaving, going off the stage, the speakers were going off as well. And Jason and I just happened to match up perfectly as we were walking off the stage. And I just looked at him and I said, that's the single most courageous thing I've ever seen a human being do in my entire life. And I said, you knocked it out of the park, buddy. And we were standing around backstage. Of course, his guys were back there waiting on him. And before they shackled him and hackled him and took him back to prison, I told him this. I did say, so you need to understand something. From now on, whenever you get asked to tell your story in AA, it's all downhill from here, man. You started off at the top, bud. To me, maybe one of the most touching things about that whole deal was GSO was having an ice cream social for us afterwards. And I'd seen Barbara at like 6:30 that morning when I left the hotel room. And I knew she would be at this. She was serving on the Al-Anon committee. And I knew she would be at this ice cream social. And so I was trying to make my way back from the dome to get over to the World Congress Center. And of course, all the volunteers, all 4,000 volunteers were invited. And people were stopping me to talk. And I was trying to be gracious. But I finally got up to the ice cream social. And I'm looking for Barbara. There's 1,000 people in the room. And I'm, where is she? Where is she? Where is she? And I finally caught her eye across the room, and she saw me, and she started running towards me. And she came up, and we hugged, and we both just started crying. And in my ear, she said, I'm so proud of Jason, and I am so proud of you. I don't think I've ever felt any closer to another human being in that moment. That was a priceless moment that I was not expecting. That was the coolest thing I ever did. It was so neat to just have a part in that. I always like to finish with this story because I'm a firm believer we are not a glum lot. So I think at about 3 years, maybe 4 years of sobriety, the treatment center where I went started asking Barbara and I to come in and tell our story on family night, which is on Wednesday nights. And so they have all the clients in there, and their highly nervous, freaked out family members are there as well. They don't know what's going on. It's a treatment center. They don't know what's going on. And so anyway, the format of the meeting is it's a two-hour meeting. And so what we do the first hour is Barbara and I tell our story together. And it's, what we were like, what happened, and what we're like now. We do that, and we go back and forth and back and forth. And then they take a break, and then they come back. And for the next hour, they get to ask questions. And the family members ask some really good questions, amazing questions. And so we were in there one night. We'd done it. And this lady raises her hand, and she says, let me get this straight. She goes, Jim, you don't drink. But Barbara, you still drink. And Barbara says, a little bit. She's a normal drinker. I mean, she has like 5/8 of a drink. So She goes, my question is, if you don't drink and you drink, how do y'all celebrate special occasions? Which I thought was a fantastic question. And I said, it wasn't but a couple of months ago, we just celebrated our 17th wedding anniversary. And I said, we went out to supper at a restaurant. She had two Cosmopolitans. I had two Dr. Peppers with cherries in them. And I said, and we had a really nice evening. I said, we had great conversation. I said, see, what you've got to understand is she's not an alcoholic. When she drinks, nobody dies. Nobody goes to jail. There's not an ambulance involved. And my wife speaks up, and I quote, she says, you see, it's like this. When Jim drinks alcohol, bad things happen to Jim. When I drink alcohol, good things happen to Jim. I was mortified. We do not have the market on crazy cornered people. It's the Al-Anons you got to watch out for. Obviously, my life today is very different. I got asked to go to work at the treatment center that I went to. And I'm in my fifth year as serving as the aftercare coordinator there. So I get them when they come out of treatment at 6 weeks, and I keep them until they have 2 years. And it's the best job on the planet because they actually pay me to bitch at newcomers for not working steps. And I can't sponsor them. So y'all know that I had trouble with all the spiritual, religious stuff. And last year, a sponsee of mine asked our district treasurer to marry him, which I thought was a brilliant maneuver on his part. And I don't know what the hell she was thinking, but she said yes. And she told me, they got engaged. It was very romantic. They took a trip to Italy, and they got engaged in Italy. And so they came back, and they both came to see me, and they said, we're not very religious people, and we know you're not either. And they said, we would like to do a really spiritual wedding, and we would like for you to marry us. And I said, okay. Did you know that with a credit card and a little bit of time online, you can become an ordained minister almost like that? So I came up with a ceremony. I actually went up to the North Carolina mountains and sat up on top of the mountain one night in our house and by myself and prayed and came up with the ceremony and brought it back, and they read it, and they said, perfect, don't change a word. And so on December 10th last year, in about 26 degrees weather outside, I married Zach and Kelly. And it was probably one of the neatest things I've ever done. And Kelly was in some trouble with the law as well, and so her judge was at the wedding. And he comes up and he says, how long have you been doing this? I go, you're looking at it, man. He said, is your ceremony copyrighted? And I started laughing. I'm like, what? If it's not copyrighted, I would like to actually incorporate some of that into the wedding ceremonies that I do as a judge. And I'm like, I'll email it to you in the morning, man. You know? But, you know, it's like that kind of stuff shouldn't happen, you know. The point I'm trying to make is Alcoholics Anonymous has given me three things that I've always wanted in my life. Value, meaning, and purpose. Thank you all so much. Y'all have been great.